So, good afternoon. Welcome to High Notes. It's the last High Notes of the season, and we are going to be broadcasting on Aspen Public Radio. So just to mention that when we get to questions, I will ask you to wait for a microphone to be brought to you, and this is for the listeners on the radio. I am delighted to see many new faces here, so I was going to begin by saying my guests need no introduction to the High Notes audience, because I think you have both frequently been a guest at High Notes, or at least occasionally. However, since I see some new people, I'm going to say, first of all, for the radio, I'm Alan Fletcher. I'm the president and CEO of the Aspen Music Festival and School. I'm with Conrad Tau, a distinguished pianist, composer. Conrad is also a violinist and all-around thinker. Conrad has a long history with Aspen. I think this is the 11th summer he's been with us. And for the first eight of those as a student?
Somewhere around there, yeah.
Yeah, something like that. But Conrad made the transition from student to guest artist a couple of seasons ago and has continued to be with us. A little more on Conrad later. Stefania Keefe, also you were with us, I think, one summer as a student.
That's right, in 1997.
1997. You must have been two.
You're off by 10 years, but I'll take it as a compliment.
But Stefan also has been a very frequent guest artist with us in past summers, and we're thrilled that he's here this summer. I should give a commercial for their activities, because both Conrad and Stefan are doing multiple performances with us this summer. Conrad gave a sensational recital last night. I think I never heard Copland Sonata sound that way, as it was sandwiched between two massive, brilliant Frederick Reshevsky pieces, and then Schumann's Carnival, which just terrified me. I'm still shaking from it, in a good way. Conrad appears tomorrow evening in an interesting recital, a kind of only in Aspen kind of program in Harris Hall. It's at, I believe, 8 p.m. Yeah, we should be sure about that.
We should really know our schedules a little bit better.
Okay, yes, 8 p.m. Harris Hall, tomorrow, Thursday. We have put together a sextet of mostly students, but Conrad will be performing. Are there any faculty joining?
No, I'm playing with entirely students.
Okay, and this is going to be a Poulenc sextet.
Correct.
Then, in the second half, Stefan has a sextet, and they're going to be doing a Brahms sextet. And you're leading as violinist, and the rest are students, is that?
There are actually two faculty members in the group, so it's half oldsters like me and half students.
Okay, great. And I also need to come back to tomorrow night in a moment, but Friday night at our final Aspen Chamber Symphony concert of the season, which is in the music tent at 6 p.m., both Stefan and Conrad are appearing. Stefan as soloist in a Mozart violin concerto, and Conrad is soloist in Beethoven's Choral Fantasy.
So I want to add one thing. I'm also playing the Ludoslavsky Partita, which is an amazing piece.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So, and that's on the first half, I think, of the Friday night. Remind me to come back to Beethoven Choral Fantasy and Ludoslavsky and all of that in a moment. But first, a surprise that only you and the millions of people listening on the radio will know. And that is that in tomorrow evening's recital program, we're going to open with something which is not announced, and that is two very young pianists who are with us as students this summer who will each be playing a couple of solo piano segments. This was an inspiration of our artistic administrator, Asadura Centurion, who observed that we have this extraordinary nine-year-old pianist with us this summer, and that Conrad came to us when he was 9 years old, I think.
Yes, indeed.
Yes. So we are looking to Conrad's past and to our own future with this. Her name is Harmony Zhu, and you really don't want to miss this. We also have another extraordinary, not as young, because she's already 12, pianist, Qixuan. She goes by the name Ding Ding, and she is also playing to open the concert tomorrow. Let's start just talking about music. And Conrad, you might talk about the Poulenc Sextet, what we should love about it or may love about it.
Yeah, the Poulenc is a wonderful piece. This is my first time playing it. And actually, all things considered, now that I'm thinking about it, my first time really doing much Poulenc in general. I've always liked his work kind of from a distance as a listener, and there's a really vibrant sense of color, particularly harmonic color, in this piece. And it kind of vacillates from between like creepy, almost spooky sonority, and then these moments of kind of harmonic crystalline clarity that at times feel almost strikingly American to my ears even. So it's this really, really, really impeccably constructed music. And I love playing with winds. I don't get to do it nearly as much as I'd like to. So I'm playing with a wind quintet of all students. These are all students who are older than me. and they're all wonderful, and they all really know what they're doing, and we've been just having a wonderful time working together. So, you know, y'all should come just to observe that, because we're going to be having a great time on stage. But it's a wonderful, really, really beautiful piece. The second movement in particular opens with this melody that I just am so enamored of. That's just so immediate, so poignant without being cloying. And that's it's a tricky balance to strike. And I think that this piece really occupies that place.
So, thinking about your work with these students, and yet they are all older than you are, I hope you won't mind if I recall Malcolm Gladwell's essay about, is it 10,000 hours? What's the thing?
Oh,
about?
I think it's 10,000, yeah.
So, although you're, I think, 20?
21. 21.
You certainly have the 10,000 hours in there, and so you are a mature, you know, performing artist.
Let's hope so. what's lovely about it is I came into rehearsal not knowing what to expect, because I love working with students in any capacity. I love that process. But this was really just coming in, and you know, this piece was new to me. It's more familiar to a lot of them. And it was just really wonderful to be in an environment where it felt like there were no egos competing at all. It was just, you know, we're all coming in, we're all here to do this thing, and we've had a great time working together. Huh.
So it's not that you came in and said, okay, listen up, here's how it's gonna go. It's...
You're the students here. Yeah. No, yeah. If anything, I think I tend to come into these situations like this anyway, but if anything, it was very much like, I wanna hear what they have to say, especially as I'm a pianist. It can, you know, sometimes our aperture is really narrow as pianists, just because of what we end up being exposed to, and sort of I suppose the conservatory culture that sometimes surrounds pianism. So it's being in a chamber environment, playing with winds. I really enjoy hearing what they have to say, and really I just. It sounds so treacly to put it this way, but I'm really learning a lot more than I suspect that they are from me this time around, for sure. Huh.
You know, working with some student composers last week, we were observing, in terms of different categories of instrument, the different ways, say, a stringed instrument speaks compared to a wind instrument. And when you're, whether in an orchestral or in a chamber situation, you have to be very sensitive to that. Do you find that with the piano and the winds?
One of the nice things about playing with piano and winds is that I am much less concerned about certain dynamic balance issues that come up more often when you're playing with strings. Because I'm not that nervous about about these wind players projecting, you know, especially in a hall like Harris. I feel like that sound is going to carry really beautifully. And there is something about the way the piano and wind sounds mesh together. They're actually they kind of don't mesh together. They don't. They're not like a seamless mix. They're distinct. They're very distinct sound worlds. So that actually is really freeing in a way, because you don't feel like you're competing for the same sonic space. Instead, you know, it's more about listening to how you can fill in the sonic space. I mean, that's how I choose to work with strings as well, but it's more challenging because I don't know if you would agree with this, Stefan, but I feel like with strings and piano, it can sort of feel like you're in the same area a lot of the time, and you're basically taking up the same sort of middle range of sound. And winds, even within the wind quintet, there's such a variety of timbre. So it's the concerns are different, basically. The way you listen is different, which is great. I mean, that's the most lovely thing about being a pianist and doing chamber music, is you kind of get to tag in to these existing ensembles, and you get to do additional stuff. You get to play with string quartets and wind quintets and what have you.
So the Poulenc is a more exotic piece that one doesn't hear so often because it's for wind quintet and piano. The Brahms Sextet is a very standard rep piece, I would say. How about your approach and the structure of your rehearsals, and what should we be listening for?
Well, the first thing I'll say is we had our first rehearsal yesterday afternoon, and although there are I'm there as a quote-unquote guest artist, and there are two faculty members and three students, immediately we realize that sort of giants like Brahms are the great equalizers, because sort of in the presence of music like that, there, you know, we're all servants of that. So the kind of differences in among us just seem to fade, and we all just sort of share our ideas. So that was exciting to see that kind of we are all equally inspired and kind of in awe of this music. The piece, I think, it's fairly early. It's Opus 18, and I would say the first movement reflects that, not in a sense of immaturity, but there's sort of a optimism and generosity and kind of loving quality, I would say, to the writing. But once you hit the second movement, everything changes. And the second movement, I think, is Brahms almost at his most tragic and severe and dark. And that's such a polar shift from the first movement that you realize that this is not sort of an emotionally simple piece. And the fourth movement, the final movement, we see that Brahms, even though he's a relatively young man when writing the piece, he already has that sort of signature trait of kind of loneliness mixed with joyful nostalgia. There's sort of a kind of wistful remembrance about it. And it's fun working with young people and seeing that maybe this is a testament to them or the testament to Brahms's music, that no matter where you are in your life, you can relate to that sort of longing for the past and kind of remembering days gone by. So it's been really fun exploring that range of emotions and range of experiences in our first 3-hour session.
Now, I think Brahms was already nostalgic or even sometimes elegiac when he was your age, so.
Right.
So tell us about the string sextet, because we just a few nights ago had Schubert's great quintet. And if you're writing a quintet for strings, you have a couple of choices. You have a string quartet to start with, but you could add a bass, or you could add another cello, as Schubert does, or you could add another viola, as Mozart does. So what happens in a sextet?
Well, so as you said, the sort of the building block, I would say, of the string chamber music repertoire is the quartet, two violins, viola, and cello. And if you want to expand on that, you can add a cello or a viola. And one, you mentioned the Schubert cello quintet. One thing that I really love about that piece is the very first phrase starts without the second cellist. So you quote unquote don't know that it's a string quintet yet. And the second phrase introduces this extra cellist. So he starts the piece with the building block of the string quartet and then adds the cellist. So you can see that that is very much in the composer's mind, that the core is the string quartet. And I would say that in this Brahms sextet, by adding a cello and a viola to the string quartet, it becomes much more kind of orchestral. There, of course, is kind of independence of voices, but a lot of the texture is the six of us playing together, or lines doubled, or lines in octaves. So I think you get kind of a more robust sound. There's something, I think, inherently fragile about the string quartet repertoire, and I think that vulnerability is why so many composers wrote their most kind of soul-searching and intimate music for the string quartet. But when you add two more forces, it kind of becomes more comfortable and, again, use the word generous in sound.
My own composition teacher used to say about string quartets that they were essentially a trio apportioned among four instruments. So a sextet gives you a lot more opportunity. Let's go to Friday night's program and start with the Mozart concerto. Tell us about that.
This Mozart concerto is the fifth, known as the Turkish concerto. And the reason why it has that nickname is in the last movement, which is a rondo, seemingly out of the blue comes this fiery, exotic section that is inspired by Turkish exoticism. And Mozart wrote 5 violin concertos, not including the Sinfonia Concertante for violin and viola, which he wrote later in his life. And these 5 concertos he wrote in 1 year. And actually, earlier in that year, his father, Leopold, wrote Wolfgang a letter in which he kind of scolded his son a little bit for neglecting the violin repertoire. So kind of, as we all do when we're trying to shut our parents up, we churn out 5 masterpieces. And this is, the 5th is definitely the most large scale and complex, and I think most inspired. For me, the slow movement is really kind of the jewel within the concerto. It is both in, well, maybe because of its construction, therefore in its feeling, very searching and kind of lost. And he goes into harmonic realms that seem so far away from where he began. So it's really kind of there's a lot of soul searching in that movement. And I'm pairing it, just to jump to the next thing, with the Ludoslavsky Partita. And the Partita was written in 1984 for the great violinist Pinchas Zukerman. And it was originally written for violin and piano. And another great violinist, Anne-Sophie Mutter, a few years later, asked Ludoslavsky to orchestrate it, which is the version that I'll be playing day after tomorrow. And I think actually there is kind of, it's interesting to see the Mozart and the Ludoslavsky, or to hear them side by side, because, you know, Mozart's music, of course, is so operatic, even his instrumental music. And in the 5th concerto, you really hear these different characters kind of playing off each other, making fun of each other, consoling each other, egging each other on. And there's a sort of duality of humor and joy with a kind of bittersweet longing and sadness and tenderness. And in the Ludoslavsky, it's almost as if he took those two characters and stretched them to kind of perverse proportions. So the joy is now kind of manic and almost nervous and demonic, and the kind of bittersweet longing now is this just almost apocalyptic mourning. So that wildness in the Ludoslavsky, I think kind of, well, I think the two kind of cast each other in an interesting light.
Let's talk about him a little more. Ludoslavsky, one of the titans of the 20th century in music, Polish and lived in Poland, so not as well known to American audiences. The concerto for orchestra, I think, is played a lot. What else?
I think the cello concerto is fairly frequently played. One of the people who's been helping me out here at the festival, taking me to rehearsals, is a Ludoslavsky scholar, so he's been telling me a bit about Ludoslavsky, so I can't take credit for all what I'm about to spout, but he apparently wrote some string quartets, which are fairly infrequently heard, a few symphonies, and I think his music is incredibly accessible to audiences. This Partita in particular, it's about 18 minutes long, and it's in 5 short movements that run into each other. And the word partita, it's sort of a little puzzling why he called the piece partita. Partita is traditionally a collection of dance movements from the Baroque era. And this piece is kind of loosely inspired by that. I would say the outer movements, 1 and 5, have kind of dance elements, but they're filled with this kind of demonic kinetic energy that's sort of a Ludoslavsky trademark. And movements 2 and 4 are fascinating because shortly before writing this piece, Ludoslavsky was introduced to the music of John Cage and the concept of chants or aleatory music. And in these inner movements 2 and 4, he experiments with that. Each of the 2 movements is a duet between the violin and a piano in the orchestra. And he doesn't specify how the 2 parts should be coordinated. So it's left to chance. So you see kind of him experimenting with these different compositional styles in this fairly compact work. So I think certainly for a player, but for a listener, I think it's also an interesting insight into what he's about.
You know, I once heard a different great European composer, Ligeti, say that from the European point of view, John Cage was one of the most important and influential American composers, and far more so than we experienced, a lot of us, in the U.S.
So, Apparently Ludoslavsky thought so too.
Yeah. And I'll mention that Stephen Stuckey, who's one of our composers in residence every summer in Aspen, is a great scholar also of Ludoslavsky, and to the extent that he has learned Polish because he's over there so much. So anyway, that's interesting. Conrad, do you play any Ludoslavsky?
I haven't, but there's a pretty hefty amount of piano music in that rep. Mm-hmm. I haven't really dived into it.
So let's talk about the Beethoven Choral Fantasy. I believe that was Beethoven's title for this piece. The piece starts as essentially a piano concerto, then has a section that's virtually a concerto for orchestra. Everybody gets something great to do. And then, without much warning, there's a choral part and parts for four soloists. So some people experience it as a sort of rough draft of the Ninth Symphony. What is your point of view?
I'd say that there's merit to that argument. I mean, also just because the melody, the main choral melody, has shades, it feels like a predecessor to the Ninth Symphony. It's an amazing piece. It also feels like a perfect Aspen piece, actually. Something about the way the piece unfolds, something about how conspicuously big the piece feels, just feels like I'm so excited to play it in the tent, because that seems like the perfect environment. You know, it's literally like heaven's opening. And the ending is just, the best part about the ending is it hits and you've got this chorus belting away and it keeps going. It's a really sustained, powerful moment, and it feels earned. But I mean, it feels so Beethovenian. It feels like the work opens with basically a 4-minute piano cadenza, and it's not a cadenza that sneaks up on you. It begins with like huge chordal statements, somewhat akin to the opening of the Emperor Concerto, and it goes and it goes on, and it's so Beethovenian. It's ostentatious in the best way. It has this aspect of presentational largeness that I love in Beethoven. And this piece also particularly has that strange effect of Beethoven in Beethoven's best and most complex stuff of taking you on harmonic journeys where you really don't know where he's going. You know, he will kind of just keep going in a harmonic sequence, and it's not clear when it's going to end, where it's going to go, and that is part and parcel of how one interprets it, how one plays it, that process of figuring out where you are. That's kind of embedded in the score, and that's always really, really fascinating as a performer to engage with. So it's an amazing piece, and it also... What's fun for me is I get to sort of be an orchestral player for a lot of the piece. After my big cadenza, there's a lot of stuff where I'm really just playing chamber music with the orchestra, which is wonderful. I mean, I love being part of the ensemble there.
Great. Well, I hope that makes everyone want to come. That is Friday at 6 p.m. You know, we have very often had choral finales on Sunday, and because of the nature of this piece, we were putting it on the Friday concert. So now I'm going to put you both maybe a little on the spot, because I heard on the radio that I was going to ask you this. I just want to talk about your own pathway into your careers. You are both young, you are both really on a world stage. I'm not going to go down all the list of the prizes and awards and engagements that both Stefan and Conrad have, but it's staggering. How did that happen? Is there any moment where you thought, oh, it's really happening now? Or did it sort of come bit by bit?
Well, I sort of started my life in music by chance. My parents are not musicians, but they're music lovers, and they started me on violin just because they thought it'd be a nice thing for me to do. And I think kind of what got the ball rolling for me is just realizing that I love music more than I love anything else. And I think that got the ball rolling for me, and that's what keeps the ball rolling for me to this day. And it's one can be tempted to sort of look for watershed moments, either in terms of decisions to become a musician or points at which careers took off. But I think actually just it's such a constant process to sort of delve deeper that in some sense the career is kind of ancillary to the life of a musician. And it brings to mind this line, a quote from the pianist Arthur Schnabel, in which he says that actually the performance itself is such a small part of his relationship with a piece. Because the amount of mental and emotional energy it takes to sort of think about a piece and live with a piece is so tremendous that it really consumes you. And I think sort of where you go to play it and what orchestras you play it with, it's sort of secondary. So I think kind of what keeps me going is just a fascination with music and in almost a selfish way, how playing it makes me feel and how much I love doing it. But also there's also the, I don't know, I'd say selfless, but the sharing aspect of trying to communicate that joy and that transcendence to listeners. So that's sort of a open-ended answer to your question.
Well, it's a very beautiful answer. I think it's an evasive one myself, but let's see how Conrad handles this.
I'm glad that I let you speak first because you kind of you've did a very good job of summing up the weird, complicated relationship that I have with that question that you asked. Sort of like, what was the path to being a professional musician? Like, what did that look like? And especially what you said about, you know, it's tempting to try to find like signposts.
Yeah.
For me, it felt like a wave of understanding. I have taken to describing my early experiences with music as actually kind of just being at the level of play. I started playing the piano so early. I started playing nursery tunes on the piano a little bit before I turned two. I've told this story many, many times. And my parents aren't musical either and weren't at all music lovers when I started. I have turned them into music lovers. I'm very proud of that. My mother has exquisite taste now. And it still feels like a process. But I started working professionally too when I'm like around the age of 12 or so. But even then, it was really just, I was motivated by it just being really fun. You know, this was something that in the early years, it was my after school activity. It was my extracurricular thing. And it was just what I loved to do, what was really exciting and what was fun and what I was learning a lot in. I think for me, when I started to gain more self-awareness at maybe, I don't know, the ripe old age of like 14, then the bigger questions started. Since I was already working professionally, then the questions that followed were sort of, well, why am I doing this? What is motivating me to do this? And I don't think I have ever had extremely clear answers to those questions. I think that one of the interesting things about having this as a job is that, you know, this is a field in which you can constantly ask yourself these big questions of like, you know, what am I really trying to do and what am I really trying to say? I think as I've gotten older, that's become a big priority in what I do is sort of like communication. Like if you were to ask me what I think that my job is about, what I think that music is about, actually I might just say it's communication. It's about communicating an idea or a feeling or something, but it's you know, the goal of a performer is on some level to be compelling and communicative. But I don't know. I mean, it's a constantly evolving relationship. And I hate to say that I fell into it because I do think that like elides some of the agency that I probably have in this history. But it really just, I've throughout my life, I've just kind of tried to follow my instincts and you know, follow the guidance of my mentors who have thankfully been by and large amazing.
Well, I want to talk about that. But I think a few years ago, I saw a wonderful interview with your mother, and for both of you, both parents are scientists. I think that's correct.
Yes,
yeah.
Both.
But some interviewer was asking your mother, you know, did you have to push Conrad very hard, you know, to make him practice or whatever? And she said, actually, we never had the wish for Conrad to be a musician. We just saw how happy it made him. And I thought that was a nice...
My mother's great. I mean, I owe everything. I mean, actually, you've done a very good job of avoiding the P word, which, you know, prodigy, which is, you know, kind of a word that hovers over you if you start young and kind of is really hard to escape. But my big issue with how we often talk about people who start young and who start their careers young the prodigy narrative, the idea tends to be like, oh, this like magical thing happened. Like you just emerged fully formed and you can do this crazy thing and everyone loves you for it. And that's never really how it goes. Yeah. That's just not realistic to, I mean, you know, and my big frustration with, you know, having done so many interviews about being young and starting young is that it often doesn't feel like there's enough room given for all the people who helped me along the way. So it's my teachers who have been, like, my track record is really, I'm really fortunate. All of my teachers have been extraordinary. My parents have been completely extraordinary. I don't think they ever had an agenda for me, aside from making sure that I eat. So, you know, I consider myself incredibly lucky. Like, when I look, I think there are some signposts, but for me, those signposts are kind of like, what teacher do you decide to work with? Or when you move to a place, like I moved to New York when I was 9 years old, my mother got a job at Columbia, and we relocated our family. If that happened at the perfect time in my life. So those are kind of the signposts, but it all feels super serendipitous, you know, like falling into, you know, playing a performance, having just the right people there. That's the weird thing about this job also is like you just try to roll with the punches and roll with what comes your way. And I don't want to say that that's the secret because I consider myself extremely fortunate in that regard.
Well, I hope you won't mind. I'm going to tell a story that happened here in Aspen some years ago. Actually, I'm going to tell it whether you mind or not. So, Conrad was here studying. His teacher, both here and for many years at Juilliard, has been Veda Kuplinski, who has also helped a lot of young people across this divide. I indeed don't use the word prodigy, because I think it's more harmful than helpful, and everyone who gets put into that category does have to emerge from that category into a career, and both Stefan and Conrad clearly have done so. But anyway, so Veda is very protective and careful, and so a major American orchestra approached and said, would you play for our gala this coming fall? Has to be Rachmaninoff Third Concerto, and Conrad actually had not played that piece. And I remember Veda coming to me and saying, I just don't think so. And I don't think it's right. But we all agreed that Conrad would learn, I think, just the first movement or something. And then we would set up an opportunity in the tent, because it's very, very different projecting a piece on this scale in a room of that scale than sitting in a practice room and saying, hey, this sounds pretty good. So he had a week before we would do this trial. He showed up with the whole concerto memorized, and it was just stunning. So Veda turned to several of us and said, well, I guess that's that. you remember that?
Oh, I remember this very well. Yeah, I feel like I've known you long enough that you've got too many stories on me.
I could go on. Hey, why don't you tell us about your new recording? Because just yesterday you announced the release of a new CD.
Thank you for the opportunity. I just yesterday was finally able. I'm one of my least favorite things about being in any sort of music industry at all, is just having to sit on news. It's like really difficult for me. I'm too impatient. But I was able to announce my next album I will record for Warner Classics. And this album is called Pictures. And it actually has a lot of the repertoire that I performed here last summer. So Pictures at an Exhibition is the centerpiece of the record. And then there is music by David Lang, two of David Lang's memory pieces, a piece by Takamitsu, Les Yeux Clos Deux, two pieces by Elliot Carter called Two Thoughts About the Piano, Intermittences in Catenaire, and a piece of mine called A Walk for Emilio, Emilio del Rosario being my first quote-unquote serious piano teacher who I studied with from the ages of 5 to 9, and who died in 2010. The whole album is kind of about these pieces that use images in a sense almost as a gateway to considering memory in all of its complexity. So the first of the Carter pieces, Intermittences, is actually a reference to Proust, to a chapter from Sodom and Gomorrah. And David Lang's memory pieces are all each individually written in memory of various friends. The first one dedicated in memory of John Cage. And these, so, you know, I was fascinated by this link, this sort of, these two really rich musical traditions of writing music based on imagery or artwork, and then music written in memory of others. And both of these traditions being very well established in throughout, you know, Western classical musical history. And it was just exciting to be able to have Pictures at an Exhibition, kind of the massive behemoth that it is, surrounded by these more contemporary works, and it plays nicely with them. And I'm really excited about this album. It was an album made pretty spontaneously, actually, with like kind of spare studio time when I wasn't even trying to make a record. Really, this started just as like a little project to maybe release something tiny digitally, and then it really became a full-blooded project, and that's how I like to work, I think. I love sort of starting with something simple and then really just trying to follow it through and see where it takes me. I feel like in my experience, I don't work that well when I come into something with a very clear agenda. And this really bloomed. So I'm really thrilled. This the album is Pictures, and it comes out in October, on October 9th. And I'm really excited. It feels like a passion project, which is really how all of these things should feel.
On what label?
On Warner Classics, yes.
Great. So Stefan, if you were conducting this interview instead of me, what would you ask Conrad?
Well, actually, you know, Conrad is obviously a performer and a prolific composer, and as someone who is only a performer, we kind of approach, when we play a masterpiece by Brahms or Mozart, it's kind of like this impeccably put together nugget from heaven, just sort of like dropped at our feet, and we spend our days contemplating it and figuring out how to do it justice. But actually, you know, composers are very human people also who toil, and, you know, these works are finely wrought. A lot of effort goes into putting them together. But that's a process that we don't really see as performers. We see the finished product. So I'm wondering, as a performer, when you're playing other people's music, especially old masterpieces, which are kind of, you know, almost like the divine word, kind of, does your composer mind kick into gear, and knowing how it's put together and how the composer arrived at these choices, is that an important part of figuring out how you want to play it?
I think that understanding a composer's thought process, or trying to hypothesize about a composer's thought process, is essential to any process of, you know, intellectually understanding a piece. So that's there. But I will say that I think my own experience as a composer has actually made me less of a, this is a loaded word to throw around, but less of a purist in a sense. Uh-huh. I don't mean to suggest that this is the case for all performer composers. I'm actually sure that there are some performer composers who put that whole thought process and authenticity on a higher pedestal, actually, than I do. But I've had the opposite experience. For me, it's kind of like I know the nuts and bolts to a certain extent behind this process. I know that sometimes it really does feel like you're just seeing what works. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's finding something that works and then trying to shape something around it. So I guess the big takeaway for me, and this almost doesn't come down to interpretation, it just comes down to how I see what I do, period, is it's just a little demystifying. Uh-huh. Which I really value. I think that it can be easy sometimes when we're talking about Brahms and when we're talking about Beethoven to get caught up in all this really mystical talk about, you know, divine inspiration and whatnot. And which, not to suggest that that isn't like a possibility, but it's just like you said, it's a very real process of just constant work. And I think that the more that we acknowledge that it's hard and difficult and work, the more honest we can actually be about how we play and what we do as musicians. And so, I don't know, I also will say that I think I do look at a score differently than some of my peers who have only been trained as performers. My tendency is to analyze a score harmonically before anything else. Mm-hmm. It also helps that I'm a pianist, so I'm used to reading two staves, and so that or three staves or four staves if you get into the contemporary repertoire. So the approach is just different. I hope that my experience as a composer has made it a little bit easier to try to immediately see a work on a large scale, you know, to really think about how it can be put together.
The reason why I asked that question is because so Conrad and I are in a newly formed piano trio together, and at our first rehearsal we were kind of just talking about music, and you mentioned the Brahms C major piano trio. Mm-hmm. And again, one of sort of the pillars of the chamber music repertoire. And as a performer, I always sort of took that first theme as just sort of, it's what Brahms wrote, and that's the way it had to be. And you had said something at that rehearsal about how it fascinated you why he came up with that melody and how he constructed that melody. And that's very much, I think, from a composer's point of view, because you think about how to create from nothing, whereas we are recreators.
And the funny thing is, when you put it that way, it contextualizes, it just makes me realize how that's just the way that my brain has been shaped. Because I've been a composer for nearly as long as I've been playing. I started kind of immediately. I've often compared it to language, just like understanding the components of language. So like, you know, I started playing nursery tunes at the piano. It's like discovering these units, these little building blocks. Like you can create a melody out of, you know, by plunking keys at a piano. It's like discovering what words are and discovering that stringing them together in this particular way creates a sentence and it creates meaning. And there's something so loaded just about that possibility. So I immediately, like, I have these sketchbooks from when I was 3 years old, of like this staff paper with like six staves on it, like huge staff paper, trying to teach myself notation, because I had just started learning to read musical notation at I think the age of three, and everything looks wrong. But you know, all my key signatures are wrong. I can't draw any of the clefs correctly, but that the process of wanting to take this and write with it was immediate. I was improvising immediately as well. Actually, this is, I do want to take a moment just to mention that sadly this was not indicated in the program notes, but one of the great things about playing that program last night with the Zhevsky pieces is that the first Zhevsky piece that I did, which is Which Side Are You On from the North American Ballads, basically the entire second half of that is improvised, is an improvisation. So that was really exciting. I got to improvise for like 7 minutes on stage. Anyway, and that was what started the program. But so I think that it's funny that you mentioned that, because I remember that conversation really well, because that melody has always fascinated me. Because to my ears, it's so singular and idiosyncratic, and yet feels completely organic. Mm-hmm. And you know, it doesn't feel like it's drawing attention to its own cleverness. Mm-hmm. And that just fascinates me. Like, how do you do that? It's just like literature. It's just like analyzing why does Joyce have this this kind of syntax? You know, why is Finnegan's Wake written the way that it is? That's endlessly interesting to me. But it doesn't register in my mind as a byproduct of composing all my life, mm-hmm. because it's just the way that my consciousness has been shaped.
Well, I love that question, Stefan. I'm going to tell just a homely story, if I may. When I was very young, 11, I had a wonderful teacher also, and I was playing a Bach G major French suite. And my teacher said, look at the problem Bach had finishing this movement. And I was dumbfounded, because how could Bach have a problem? How could there be any difficulty for him? And yet, once she showed it to me, I thought, it's so true. He gets to a certain place, and then you feel a sort of struggle. And I came to find, by the way, that one of the things I love most about Brahms is that you really feel the problems that he was setting for himself or that he was trying to solve, and almost more than other composers at that level.
Actually, now that you mention it, this goes back to what I was talking about earlier in terms of Beethoven often being about the process of harmonic progression. I think that I get a similar effect from Beethoven, especially late Beethoven, where the chord progressions really get confusing in a sense. On paper, it starts to look really thorny. And I get that same sense of sort of you are hearing the process. It's almost like hearing the material process of like composing. You hear David Lang once wrote a work I think in 2000 or so called This Was Written by Hand, where his whole experiment was after years of writing on a computer, would his music sound any different if he wrote it by hand? And his conclusion was that it did. And what I love about a lot of that Beethoven stuff, where you're just like, how many other keys are we going to go to? You can almost hear the gears turning. And I really admire that. That even goes back to the demystifying thing. I sort of like music that where you feel like it's not about creating this illusion that everything emerged fully formed. It's about, in a weird way, inviting the audience into your process. And I think it's possible to do that as a performer, too.
Sure. I mean, I think it depends on which composer you're playing a bit, too. I think definitely in Beethoven, like I was mentioning to you the other day about the Fourth Piano Concerto, which has like the most sublime opening and surprising opening. But actually, if you look at his early drafts, it's almost criminal to say this about Beethoven, but it's comparatively very pedestrian. And uninspired. So clearly, but I've just been sort of steeped in the world of Mozart because I'm playing Mozart in a couple days. And with that, it almost looks like it's so inevitable. Just the maybe the wrong word to use, but how perfect it is. That it is sometimes tricky to think that, you know, here's a guy that, you know, the sausage had to be made.
Well, Beethoven, in his very extensive sketchbooks, trying things out, very often writes in German, schlecht, you know, terrible. And indeed, whenever he writes that, whatever was on that page, you never see again. This has gone so well, and I have not asked Conrad to return the favor to Stefan yet, but I thought we might, unless you want to right away, we might see if there are comments or questions, because we don't have that much time left. Okay, we'll start right here and get the mic down first.
Having heard you play the Mendelssohn on the violin back in those days, I wonder whether it's been recorded. And second, I'd like to find out how the playing of the violin and composing and the piano stack up in your perceptions.
So you've heard me do Mendelssohn violin? Oh my gosh, that must have been like 6 or 7 years ago. My gosh, how do playing the violin and piano stack up? I think deep down, I think that I always knew I was probably going to focus more on playing the piano as a solo performer more. Even going way back, the violin was my second instrument. I started taking violin lessons primarily because my parents couldn't find piano teachers for me when I first started playing on my own, because no one wanted to teach a 2-year-old to play the piano. when their hands can basically only fit on two keys. So it was advised to me that the violin might have been a good idea because unlike pianos, violins come in extra small sizes. But I loved the violin and I still love the violin. But I think that I treasure ultimately the violin less for my experiences playing as a soloist with orchestra, like with the Mendelssohn Concerto and whatnot, but I treasure it more for the chamber music experience it gave me and the orchestral experience it gave me. I did string quartet repertoire from the age of like 6 or 7, which is amazing, being exposed to really great string quartets at a really young age. That was wonderful. I got an opportunity to go to Fischhoff when I was really, really young, and that was the best thing about being a violinist, and I played in orchestras, and you know, in many ways, actually, the memories that I hold closest to my heart of being a student here in Aspen were of being a violinist here and being a section player, and you know, the story I always like to tell was my very first summer being here as a 10-year-old, and being in festival orchestra and playing Shostakovich 5, and David Halen was concertmaster that week. And I just remember being at rehearsal early and trying to figure out fingerings and him just sitting next to me and working out fingerings with me. And I knew who he was. Like I was young, but I wasn't that naive. I knew who he was. And it was just the most wonderful thing. And he, of course, everyone can attest to this. He's the incredibly nice, kind, incredibly supportive person. So those are the memories I hold closest to my heart here, and I love the violin for that. You know, as pianists, we don't get that as much, or it's not guaranteed. But as a solo instrument, the piano was the thing that I immediately gravitated towards, and so. But my gosh, that is a blast from the past.
How about right here?
So, Stefan, you mentioned one of the things that you absolutely love about playing is being able to share that experience with other people and the audience. And Conrad, you also mentioned that you see your role as a communicator. I wonder if you all think at all about your audiences, and in particular, how you make this chamber or classical music accessible, not just to your generation, but future generations. And that's something that in the arts we struggle with a little bit, is how do we make this accessible, interesting, and inspiring for a variety of people?
Well, I think, you know, going back to why I love playing music is I think there's something actually very comforting about playing music, because you realize that people who wrote the music, no matter how far away or how long ago this was, they felt the same things that you feel. And somehow normalization of your own emotions and realizing that people, that you're not alone, is a very comforting and sort of life-affirming feeling. And I think figuring out a way to sort of convey that to people who aren't necessarily familiar with classical music, and figuring out a way to get them to realize that those things that we're trying to tell them, they already know, in some sense, is an important part of it. You know, people are always saying that classical music is dying or dead or suffering, but I think when people do take the time to listen, they can be very profoundly moved, because they are recognizing something that they already knew to be true inside themselves. So somehow tapping into that is an important thing. I actually have been thinking a lot about the role of the audience in my work as a performer. I don't really have an answer, but I'm not sure whether do I want to be aware of their presence when I'm playing. And one of my heroes is a violinist named Mark Steinberg, who's the first violinist of the Brentano String Quartet. And he kind of summed it up perfectly. He said, you know, is the audience a spectator, an eavesdropper, or a collaborator with the performer? So are they kind of dropping in on an intimate moment that you're having by yourself or with your fellow musicians on stage? Or are we all in this together? Or are we performing for the audience? And that doesn't solve the problem of, you know, classical music for future generations. But I think that question, you know, what is the role of the audience, is an important one, both for us as interpreters, but also to recruit new people to fall in love with our music.
I also would like to add that, like, that question is kind of exactly why I try to characterize what I do as being a communicator. Because I think that truth be told, I don't even know if it's my job, or I don't know if it should be our job as performers to make things quote-unquote accessible aside from, or let me rephrase that. The kind of accessibility that I'm ultimately interested in is a very straightforward material kind. Like, quite literally, like, are concerts accessible to people? Once we get past that point, then we're starting to talk about this much more nebulous notion of accessibility, which can be useful and productive, but I think can also be a little dangerous and limiting, because once we start to really reify what is accessible, we start basically creating barriers and boundaries for ourselves, and not necessarily the productive kinds, not necessarily the ones that you kind of want to brush up against. I think that I think I really believe in just coming into something and being really honest about what you're trying to communicate, and I believe that audiences are totally receptive to that. I also will say that in the conversation, it's worth mentioning that classical music has kind of been dying, according to the press, for almost a century now, maybe more.
It's a slow death.
It's a very protracted. It's like, just get it over with already. But it's also, I will say, one of the things I love to do is I love contemporary repertoire, and I genuinely believe that that is maybe part, kind of the key to moving forward and creating a concert environment that feels, and I hesitate to use this word, but it's kind of the only one that works, to have the concert space be relevant. Because I do think that that's important. I do think that it's important to have like a presence in, you know, in concert halls that feels immediate to people's real experiences in the world. And just kind of by its very nature of being composed recently, contemporary music has that purpose. And also I will say, I will say it till I'm blue in the face. I love working with young people, and young people respond really well to contemporary music. And also in my experience, everyone, you know, audiences really do. I think as long as performers, we don't come into it with a sort of paternalistic attitude, you know, as long as we're not coming into this, the concert space saying, this is how you should respond to this thing. This is what you should like. This is the knowledge you need to be a real music lover. And, you know, I think as long as we don't come in with that attitude, I think audiences understand that. I mean, you know, we're all people, you know, and we're all trying to communicate in our own way. So this is just one method. I don't know. This is why I consider what I do communication rather than anything else.
Well, I think that's a perfect place to conclude. Our time is up, but thank you all for being here, and thank you, Conrad and Stefan.
Thanks for coming.